Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the debate over whether it's time to break up big tech. And a former Massachusetts correction officer's story of workplace bullying.
She sought help, but she says that she did not get help from her superiors in the Department of Correction.
Plus, a Boston cop writes a novel drawing on his experiences.
There is a certain realism that I've experienced, because I've been a police officer for 14 years, that you've just seen things and you know how people react, and you actually know what it's like to be scared when you're the one who's supposed to be in charge.
It's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We want to begin the show today by asking, is big tech too big? Our question follows the plan from Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. She says if she's elected president, she'll direct the Justice Department to break up the so-called Big Three. You probably know who they are. Here's Warren talking about this earlier this month at South by Southwest.
I'm deeply concerned right now that the space around companies like Amazon, Facebook, Google is now referred to by venture capitalists as the kill zone. So my view is break those things apart and we will have a much more competitive, robust market in America.
Joining us to talk about this is Boston Globe tech columnist Hiawatha Bray. Hiawatha, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Is big tech too big? Should the government do something to break up the Big Three? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Hiawatha, let's start. What exactly is Senator Warren proposing to do here?
Well, she isn't that exact, but she has a couple of general principles that she's laid out. One of them is the idea of rolling back a lot of the acquisitions that these companies were allowed to make in recent years that let them get bigger and bigger. For example, in the case of Facebook, they acquired two messaging companies that they have really turned into global giants, WhatsApp and Instagram. And she's saying they should be required to sell those off as separate businesses and instead of holding on to them. You have the example of Google and I believe one of the companies she's mentioned was YouTube, which they acquired. And, of course, which is the world center for streaming video on the Internet, and the idea that they should have to sell that off. And, of course, Amazon acquired famously the supermarket chain Whole Foods. And she also mentions the shoe company Zappos. Mm-hmm. And her idea would be have them sell those off. The other idea she has is this notion that a company should not be able to sell its own products into a market that it already controls. This specifically focuses on Amazon, which is really an interesting subject. Amazon sells stuff that competes against the people who sell stuff on Amazon. So if you're a merchant, you sell your stuff through Amazon, Amazon will come along then and sell the same product itself. Now, that's not necessarily the end of the world. You go into a supermarket and you see that. The store has its own brand next to the big national brand. But with Amazon, the big difference is they control the entire storefront online, and they can make sure that their brand shows up on top and you don't even see the other guy's brand. Mm-hmm. And there's even a report in the Wall Street Journal last week that they're starting to do just that with their phone app. They're testing it. So you do a search for batteries on Amazon, and the first thing you see is Amazon batteries. And only later can you see batteries from other vendors. She's saying she'd outlaw that. They wouldn't be allowed to do it. If they sell batteries for other companies, they're not allowed to sell their own brand of batteries. So those are the two key things that she's talking about. And, it's a complicated issue, and it's hard to know just exactly what the effects, the benefits, or the damages would be.
Right. So, and when you've written about this, you've said it isn't exactly a radical idea when you put it in historical context. What do you mean by that?
No, what I mean is it's not a radical idea to say, let's go after big tech companies, because this has happened in American history, certainly in the last century, time after time after time. And some people have said, well, it'll damage the competitiveness of the American tech industry. Nothing of the kind seems to have happened. If anything, there's reason to think it may have helped the competitiveness of the American tech industry. They went after AT&T. They went after IBM multiple times. In fact, it was just a few years ago. IBM got sued in 1956. I didn't even mention this in my – I didn't have room. They got sued for antitrust in 1956. They signed a consent decree that covered IBM's net activities for the next 40 years. It only recently expired. And of course, we all know what happened to Microsoft. And none of these cases, each of these cases harmed the company that was targeted. It really undercut their business. But the rest of the tech sector continued to flourish. And some would argue it flourished because of these cases, that these companies did not crush their rivals because of this. So in and of itself, the idea of going after big tech is not that shocking. It's happened a lot.
But there were legal grounds there, right? I mean, in terms of legally how this was done in the past, and if these companies can expect to be harmed, as they have been done in the past, they will likely fight it, and they will likely fight it on legal grounds. So, for example, you know, saying that my acquisitions have to be rolled back if I'm Facebook, or I can't sell certain things. I mean, this is kind of a different thing when you're talking about technology like this as opposed to what's happened in the past, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's one of the big problems, the biggest problem I have with everything that Elizabeth Warren is talking about. I just don't see how any of this actually works in practical terms. First, how do you make these companies spin this stuff off? That might be doable. Depends on how thoroughly integrated they are into the company's operations. But having first approved these mergers to then turn around and say, oops, we've changed our mind, we're gonna take them all apart now, would a court really look kindly on that? It's hard to imagine that a court will just shrug and say, okay, you can change your mind whenever you feel like it, after this guy's invested billions of dollars. It's going to be a real challenge to persuade a court to even do that, even if it's practical. The other thing that drives me crazy about all this is the whole idea that we're going to make, say, Facebook or Google sell off certain of their businesses, and that's going to solve the big problems that we are concerned about with things like privacy, bias, all these kinds of issues about the way they operate. Let's say Facebook sells off Instagram and WhatsApp. What has that got to do with anything? They're still Facebook. Right. They still have information on 2 billion people. Well, they still have this huge dominant share of the advertising market. None of the things that are really problematic about Facebook's business model would be affected in the slightest by that. You sit there and you look at it and you go, why are they even doing that? I don't get the point.
Because the real issue, really, I think that has so many people concerned about the big three is privacy. Right?
Yeah, the privacy and their abuse, or potential, in some cases, flat-out abuse of our personal data. Also, the question of, to me, it's a double-barreled thing. First, no institutions in human history have known more about us than Facebook and Google. Not even East Germany knew that much when they were spying on everybody about everything about us. But secondly, they're the ones who decide what we know. Because they control so much of the flow of information. If a company like Google or Facebook doesn't want people to know certain things, they can actually go a long way toward keeping us from ever finding it out. That is an incredible amount of power, and it's really worrisome, but I don't see how antitrust gets at it. That's my big question about it.
Right.
Oh, and one last thing. Amazon. On what planet is Amazon a monopoly? I know they look big, but they only have 50% of the online retail market, and that's only 10% of the total retail market. Whole Foods is like 3% of America's grocery sales. They're not a monopoly. They're gigantic. I know they feel like a monopoly, but they're not. So what are we going to hit them with an antitrust suit for? I don't get it.
So is it really a case then for tighter regulation here, maybe?
We may need different laws. Exactly. We may have to think entirely differently about how to deal with this. One thing she said, I think she has a really good point on, this whole thing about Amazon being able to sell into a market that they created and basically overthrow the company that the companies that are using Amazon to sell their products. They can sit back, watch the products that other people are buying on Amazon that do really well, and then say, fine, we'll start making that product, and then push the other guys right out of the market. They are in a position to do that, and I think you could make a good case that that might even be an unfair trade practice right now. Maybe the FTC can go after them for that. But that is something I think that makes a lot of sense, because that really does strike me as wildly unfair. But what do you do in terms of antitrust for all of these other problems? I just don't know. We're going to have to figure out things like privacy by doing some kind of a national privacy law, I would think. And that's much more of a logical way to go than thinking you're going to fix this problem with antitrust.
I also want to mention, in terms of, just congressional action here. You know, we saw when Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg went before Congress last year, we saw lawmakers questioning big tech companies, if you will, and there was a seeming lack of awareness about how technology works. We have a clip here from Senator Lindsey Graham asking Mark Zuckerberg whether he felt Facebook is a monopoly in the social media industry, and he compared the company's lack of competition to the car industry. Let's listen to this clip.
Car companies face a lot of competition. If they make a defective car, it gets out in the world, people stop buying that car, they buy another one. Is it an alternative to Facebook in the private sector?
Yes, Senator. The average American uses 8 different apps to communicate with their friends and stay in touch with people, ranging from texting apps to email.
It's the same service you provide.
Well, we provide a number of different services.
Is Twitter the same as what you do?
It overlaps with a portion of what we do.
You don't think you have a monopoly?
It certainly doesn't feel like that to me.
Okay.
So, Hiawatha Bray, are we in a situation where Congress needs help handling these issues?
Well, yeah, I think so. That's obvious. Although I'm not sure that clip really demonstrates it. I mean, what you're hearing is the classic defense that you hear from people in Silicon Valley, not entirely disingenuously. They're saying, look, we feel as though our position is under constant threat. We could be overthrown at any moment by somebody who comes along and offers something better, that's more attractive, and we don't feel like we're a monopoly. And they actually say that all the time. And I don't know that it's, I think Senator Graham was raising a legitimate point there, in that they are, for all practical purposes, a monopoly. But Mark Zuckerberg is coming back saying, you know, if what we're doing is so terrible, people can stop using us at any moment. And indeed, that could happen. However, the recent history suggests it's not terribly likely. They've seen some diminution of their user base, but not all that much. People used to say the same thing. I mean, Microsoft would say, you know, people could knock us over at any time. All they have to do is make a better product. Here we are all these years later, and Microsoft is as powerful as ever. It turns out that once these companies get a foothold, it's very, very, very hard to dislodge them. And so I think Lindsey Graham is actually on the right track when he says, you know, for all practical purposes, when it comes to social networking, you're a monopoly and you've got to deal with it.
You know, we're hearing just now, apparently, from the Wall Street Journal reporting that Facebook will remove age, gender, and zip code targeting for housing, employment, and credit-related ads in an effort to settle discrimination suits. Significant, Hiawatha?
I think so. I don't want to make it bigger than it is, because I think this is probably a very small part of their business. But it does go to show just how much of a social influence these guys have and how unprepared they are to deal with the real implications of it. I mean, basically what they're doing here is they use their algorithmic advertising methods to basically allow advertisers to slice and dice in all kinds of different ways. And apparently nobody there sat down and really thought through how that relates to the housing market, where you have federal laws that set real limits on how you can advertise in order to avoid racial discrimination. And they didn't take that seriously. We're Facebook. We don't have to think about stuff like that. It's all about the algorithm. And now they're being told, no, it is not just about the algorithm. It's about American law about housing discrimination, and it has to apply to you too. And that's something that this, and you see this throughout the history of Facebook and other tech companies. Their attitude is, we're just going to go ahead and let the technology go where it leads us, and questions about the social implications of what we're doing, we're just going to act like they don't apply to us because we're an all new kind of business. That's what happened here, and now they're finding out, no, sorry, the laws that apply to other people who advertise real estate also apply to you. This effort by Elizabeth Warren is trying to do the same thing through antitrust. My big problem, though, is, you know, here's the big thing. With antitrust law, the whole idea is usually has traditionally been you have to show how the consumer is being harmed by a monopoly. If Facebook is a monopoly, and it is, how are they harming consumers? And it's almost impossible to show any harm. They're giving their product away. Nobody has to use it if they don't want to. And people love it. Where's the harm? How are you going to sue them under antitrust law? You can sue them for violating anti-discrimination law. Maybe we could hit them for unfair trade practices. But when you come to antitrust, it's going to be real hard.
Okay, Hiawatha, I know you have to go. Hiawatha Bray writes about technology and business for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, glad to be here.
Listeners, we want to remind you that we'd like to hear from you in this conversation. Are the big three tech companies too big, and should the government step in and break them up? Our number is 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Also joining us in this conversation is Heba Hafiz. She's a Boston College law professor and expert in antitrust law. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we just heard from Hiawatha Bray, who said antitrust here is difficult. It's impossible to show harm to the consumer. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in this case, the antitrust laws are clearly there to as consumer protection statutes. They're focused on protecting consumer welfare. That has meant that much of current enforcement has focused on the impacts of vertical mergers, right? Vertical acquisitions like Facebook's acquisition of Instagram or other conduct by firms that have monopoly power. They've focused on the prices that consumers pay for goods, right? Are the prices going up or down? But another way of thinking about that focus of current antitrust enforcement is that the antitrust enforcement agencies are focused on the success of the most efficient firms, right? It's concerned with protecting competition and innovation, but not with the goal necessarily of helping smaller businesses that may be less efficient, right? So the goal is to ensure that firms can effectively compete to more efficiently provide goods to consumers. And it seems like what Warren's proposals do is they don't quite clarify what she would do if it turned out that the mergers that she wants to unwind in fact turned out to create more efficient products, right? More efficiencies than would otherwise exist if, say, Google hadn't bought Waze to improve its Google Maps. So it really comes down to a kind of policy question, right? If a firm is more efficient, it provides goods at lower cost to consumers, consumers are getting lower prices, should we break them up to allow smaller firms that may be less efficient to succeed, even if that would mean increasing prices to consumers? She doesn't answer that question. At this point, her proposal is focusing almost exclusively on small businesses.
And I guess what about this whole privacy issue and the control of information here? I mean, how much of an argument is that when you're dealing with from an antitrust point of view? I mean, is this the wrong way to deal with it?
Yeah, most privacy concerns and privacy issues under the law have focused on really trying to figure out how to establish privacy protections under a separate statutory regime that doesn't really interact with the focus and goals of the antitrust laws, which are to ensure a consumer welfare. So at this point, really, Congress has to figure out how to get its head around all of these privacy issues. Getting in through the back door through antitrust won't resolve the trickiest problems that companies like Facebook and Google are facing with respect to privacy litigation and privacy concerns.
And what about the second point that Hiawatha talked about regarding Senator Warren's proposal, not allowing these companies to sell products on the markets that they control, favoring their own products?
Right. So that there's been a lot of attention to that for good reason. There's been coverage that this has impacted smaller businesses, that Amazon has done this in the context of diapers.com, for example. The difficulty with antitrust litigation about that conduct is that there hasn't been demonstrated evidence that, in fact, Amazon's engaging in this conduct has has increased prices to consumers for goods in the relevant market that Amazon is doing that conduct in. So until we see evidence, right, that this is in fact increasing prices to consumers, there really isn't a lot of room for the antitrust laws to do anything. This fits into what's called predatory pricing doctrine, right? There's a concern that big companies can lower prices to consumers below, say, their marginal costs, and that because other smaller competitors won't be able to compete, right, those big companies will put them out of business, and they will then, as soon as they're out of business, they'll raise the prices back up, right? And current antitrust law requires both steps to be in place, right? It requires the government or the plaintiff to show that a big company has lowered its price below marginal cost and then has recouped, right, has tried to then raise the prices up once the competitor is gone. There's been a lot of criticism in the scholarship that standard is too onerous, and that, and in particular as applied to Amazon and these platform companies, that it doesn't work when a platform can say, you know, maybe make up for a price reduction in one market by raising prices in another market based on all the data that, say, Amazon is getting about what consumer preferences will allow them to charge. So there really has to be a rethinking within the agencies and even within the courts about whether or not different presumptions and different rules should apply for predatory pricing when we're dealing with platform markets.
Okay, I want to bring another voice into the conversation here. Michael Strain, Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank, is joining us from Washington. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So do you see any case here for regulating or breaking up these big three?
I really don't, and the reasons I don't have been pretty well articulated by your previous guests. You know, you have to kind of step back and say, what is the purpose of antitrust policy or competition policy? And the purpose is to allow competitive markets to deliver a variety of goods and services of high quality at low prices to American consumers. And that's the standard that has been used in the United States for a half century. It's the right standard. And we have to, I think, look and see whether or not any of these companies are a threat to consumers or consumer welfare according to those metrics, apart from any of these vague notions, oh, they're big, oh, they're powerful, oh, they play a large role in our lives. And, you know, when you do that, like your previous guests have said, you see that prices are extremely low. In many cases, the prices are free. There's, some economists even believe that Amazon is lowering the rate of price inflation for the overall macroeconomy because its prices are so low. And of course, Google, Facebook are not charging consumers for their prices.
But what about the cost of our data? Right? I mean, that's something that we haven't, you know, the market costs might be low, but they're low because we're giving these companies our personal information that they can then resell, right, and make a profit from. So how do we even begin to try to get a handle on that and consider it when we're considering how these companies operate?
Well, I think it's a difficult question. I think that the kind of notion of personal responsibility and agency gets lost in a lot of these conversations. I mean, it is the case that Google and Facebook look at what I am doing on Google and on Facebook, and they use that information to help target advertisements to me. So I think the first question is, is there really a lot of harm being done there? I see advertisements that their algorithms think that I would like. That helps companies to sell products to me. That helps me to find products I might like to buy. You know, that doesn't seem like it. I mean, it's painted nefariously, but that doesn't actually seem like it's that big of a problem in and of itself. And secondly, all the information that I give to Google and Facebook, I'm voluntarily submitting. I mean, it's not like they're, breaking into my bank account or knocking down my front door to take things from me. And you know, that means that on some kind of fundamental level, that means that I am okay with that trade. I'm okay giving them my search history or you know, letting them, you know, see things that I write on Facebook in exchange for using their platform. Now, you know, is there a role for, you know, making sure that, you know, Facebook and Google are transparent about, you know, when you download an app, you're going to, you know, give the app access to your information, you know, things of that nature. I mean, sure, that's a very reasonable conversation to have. But that conversation is very different than a conversation about breaking these companies up. And you would want to have that conversation whether there was one Facebook or five Facebooks, or whether Facebook was out of the picture and there was a different social network platform in place. So I think to mix the two up, I think, confuses the underlying issue.
I want to go to a caller. Alan is calling from Salem. Alan, you're on the air.
The amount of full-time apologists for the Facebooks and the Googles of this world is just amazing. Number one, Hiawatha Bray is wrong. Giving away the product in no way negates the fact that, first of all, even if you're not a subscriber to Facebook, a user, they keep shadow profiles on everybody. And as to consent, what this other gentleman, I forget his name, that you just had speaking.
Michael.
Yeah, I mean, he's terrible. I mean, he's really a hired gun for the Facebooks of the world. People don't give real consent. They don't read the user agreements, and they really don't know the scope of the data files that are being exchanged and what they're linked to. They don't know how they're used, and they don't know how it's interfering in their lives and the type of choices they make in their private life. When was the last time a person read a 30-page user agreement?
Well, I think we're gonna let Michael respond to that, because I think, Michael, you did say there's a loss of personal responsibility as part of the conversation. So what would you say to Alan, who says, you know, there's a lot of data mining going on here that the average consumer probably does not understand?
So I understand that people are concerned about this, and on some level I understand why. But the behavior that people exhibit is at odds with this concern. If you go back in time about a year ago to the big scandal with Facebook that led to Mark Zuckerberg testifying before Congress, where we learned that private information for as many as 87 million users was sold to a private company. If you were reading the newspaper or watching the news, it would have been impossible to miss this conversation. Facebook reports that there was basically no change in the habits around privacy and protecting information of Facebook users following that large amount of media attention. It is very easy. So unlike Facebook, I don't really care about anything I put on Facebook. If I write something on Facebook or do something on Facebook, I assume that the entire world is going to see it. I do care what's in my email inbox. My email inbox has a lot of private information that I wouldn't want the rest of the world to see. It's very easy to set up two-factor authentication and other basic privacy protections on a Gmail, a Google-owned Gmail inbox. Hardly any Gmail users do that, despite how simple it is and despite how effective that is to protect information that actually is or should be confidential. So so people's behavior really is at odds with this notion that there's you know, a lot of you know, actual concern about privacy.
Well, and I wonder, Heba, you have about a minute left here. Would you like to add to that?
Sure. No, I you know, I think that there are real consent issues with respect to Facebook and Amazon and so on aggregating data that we may or may not know what they're using it for. And this is something that doesn't quite have to do with the antitrust laws. Has more to do with what Congress wants to build a policy around in terms of what a privacy statute would look like that would adapt to the current realities of social media. I think there are real open questions and a kind of revolutionary moment for figuring out how we allocate the benefits of who gets to benefit from monetizing data. Is it, should it be Facebook? Should people who are providing the data share in those monetary benefits? Those are real questions that Congress will have to answer.
Okay, and questions we'll probably be talking about again. Heba Hafiz, professor of law at Boston College, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also, Michael Strain, director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, a former Massachusetts correction officer's story of workplace bullying. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We want to talk now about a former Massachusetts correction officer's story of workplace bullying and harassment. Mary Catherine DeFazio tells the Boston Globe her complicated story that began with the sexual assault by her now ex-husband. It resulted in the loss of her career after shocking levels of harassment in the Massachusetts prison system. Joining us to talk about this is Boston Globe reporter Jenna Russell, who wrote DeFazio. DeFazio's story. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So Jenna, Mary Catherine DeFazio was a correction officer. She worked in Walpole and in Gardner in prisons there, and she faced problems among her coworkers after reporting this attack by her husband, who we should say pleaded guilty. Can you describe what happened to her?
Sure. Mary Catherine had a career in the correction system, and after the assault, the sexual assault by her husband, she asked to work at a different prison to put some distance between her and what had happened. He was also a former corrections officer. So she landed at a new workplace, still within the system, and very soon she began to experience quickly escalating harassment and bullying in the workplace that started with just insults. The insults multiplied. She described experiences ranging from having people push her, having people throw things at her. She eventually got to the point where she felt unsafe in the workplace because people would hang up on her, as she described it, when she would call other officers and other parts of the prison. It was clear that people did not have her back there, and obviously in an atmosphere where safety and security were of paramount importance.
So did she think that a lot of this harassment was because she had reported this assault by her husband and she sort of went against one of the brothers in the correction officers union or something? I mean, what was the reason for this?
Well, I think it's very hard, probably for any victim of this kind of treatment to really pinpoint what the reasons are. And in her case, as you said at the outset, like any case, it was complicated and it was complex. And this is a work environment where there aren't a lot of women. She was new to this particular work site, but she did feel that there were people in the system, not necessarily at the prison where she was working at that time, but people who had been loyal to her ex-husband. And there were people who said to her quite blatantly that they didn't believe her claims of sexual assault. There were people who questioned whether anything had happened and whether she could have genuinely suffered the kind of PTSD and trauma related to that. So she did feel that that was a very real part of what was happening to her.
And she reported the bullying. What happened?
She did, not right away, but she eventually reported it and reported it more than once. And as she describes it, at first there was very little response to what she was telling her supervisors, authorities at the prison. Eventually, they did open an investigation, and that took about a year to come to a conclusion. And it's impossible for us to say conclusively that the department did not punish anyone for the bullying because they, as their policy dictates, they were not willing to discuss in detail her individual case. They did tell us that that any matters that needed to be dealt with in terms of her allegations were dealt with. But she tells us that she was never notified of any kind of discipline for the people who were harassing her. And she came away from that investigation not only with discipline of her own for some unrelated matters that turned up in the course of the conversations, but very much believing that, that nothing was ever going to be done about this problem.
You know, we should say we did ask the Department of Correction to just comment, and they did send a statement today saying that the department has zero tolerance for workplace violence in any form, and any allegations of staff misconduct are taken seriously and investigated, which I assume is pretty much what the department said to you when you were looking into this for your story.
They did. That is pretty much verbatim the statement that they gave us. So that left us to try and piece together from the court documents that we were able to obtain a little bit more insight about their take on this and their response. And some of that was concerning and did give the impression, without having their own full account, that they perhaps did not take it as seriously as some others might.
Mm-hmm. Is it difficult? I mean, when you're doing this story, I wonder the journalism process. When you have someone telling you a story like this and you want to be as fair and balanced as possible, but you're looking at this and saying, this is an unbelievable story. How do you balance it and verify what's happening?
It is, as you say, Deb, very challenging, especially with something like this, where the department or another state agency is not willing to sit down and hash out the whole timeline and chronology of events. So we look for cases like this one where it has been through the courts and there is a lot of documentation there that we can look at. And even more importantly, this was a case where several of Mary Catherine's colleagues who witnessed what happened were very willing to speak with us repeatedly on the record and verify and corroborate the account that she was giving us. That was critical. And so was, you know, the investment of quite a bit of time in the story. I spent months getting to know Mary Catherine and interviewing her repeatedly about the same events. And, you know, I don't think it was an easy process for her to get through, but she was very consistent in her storytelling, and she did feel very strongly about telling it in full and using her full name and doing what she could to try to help other people feel less alone.
Do you think if she hadn't filed suit without the court documents, would you have felt as comfortable doing this story?
That's a hard question to answer. Mm. I don't know if I would have. I've been interested in this issue for a couple of years at least, and I've taken a look at a lot of cases of alleged harassment and talked to a lot of people. And this case really stood out, not only for what happened to her, but I think what happened in terms of the response when she raised her concerns, but it stood out too for the documentation that was available, and that's why ultimately we decided this was a story that we needed to tell.
Mm-hmm. And part of the reason you're looking into this is because you're looking at how the state is dealing with workplace culture and workplace bullying and harassment, right? Because there's a bill again before lawmakers at the State House. Why don't you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So this proposed legislation goes back about a decade when it was first filed in Massachusetts and didn't get a lot of attention at that time. I think this is one of those issues that has really kind of picked up some momentum in recent times, especially with what's been going on with the Me Too movement and a lot more awareness about kind of toxic influences in a lot of different kinds of workplaces. So for the first time ever, I believe, this legislative session, this bill now has more than 100 co-sponsors. It's still, you know, I talked to some of the people who are involved in writing the bill, and they feel like there's still a lot of work to be done in terms of public awareness and understanding, but they do feel like they are making progress in terms of bringing attention to this issue.
And some business leaders say it's not necessary. There's still that opposition there, correct?
Absolutely, yes. There are definitely, I think, many business leaders who feel like this kind of new law is not necessary, that there are mechanisms in place already to address problems like these, and that in some sense they would be exposed unfairly to liability that they feel may not really be their duty or their responsibility.
And when you talk about DeFazio's story and telling that story, I'm wondering, is that something that some folks could say is different maybe? You know, you're talking about the prison system. That's a tough place in general, right? I mean, it's not like a small business, right? So what would you say to those folks who say, well, it's prison, Jenna, what do you expect, kind of thing, right?
It's so true, and this is a conversation I've had with people since the story was published and with editors here, and I think, you know, we were drawn to this story because it is in some ways a very extreme version compared to what you might get in another environment. And yet at the same time, I think that what you say is true, that allows people to kind of set this aside and say, well, this is a very rough environment. We already know that it can be traumatizing, not just for prisoners, but for the correction officers who work there, who see very high rates of mental health issues and substance abuse, and have a suicide rate that is much higher than other groups of employees. So there is a lot of trauma there. And I think what I would say about that is that I would hope that would make this an even more important issue to address in that environment, not just for the good of people who might become victims of bullying, but for everybody in that workplace to make sure they can be healthy and go to work every day and feel okay.
So this started with Mary Catherine DeFazio in 2010. And you say she really has watched her life. You write that she really, and write beautifully, by the way, that her life really spiraled out of control. So in 2019, how would you say she's doing now? Is she going to be able to recover from this?
So as I think anyone who read the story would deduce, Mary Catherine is a very strong person, very determined. She talked to me about how she feels she is a different person now in many ways, and that's very hard for her. But she is moving forward. She's trying to find a new kind of career, and she's trying to build herself a life that where she can find some peace. She said to me several times that the one thing she hopes is just to be able to have a place that's peaceful, where she can live quietly and kind of beyond these problems of her past. But I think one thing that is often overlooked when we talk about this kind of workplace harassment are the financial consequences for people, which can be devastating. And experts have said to me that, you know, whether you're terminated or whether you realize you have to leave a job, either way, you're often left without your livelihood, without the career you may have invested years in. And that can be, you know, just as burdensome as some of the emotional consequences that people carry forward.
Jenna Russell, reporter for the Boston Globe. You can find a link to her story about Mary Catherine DeFazio at our website, radioboston.org. Jenna, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, a Boston police officer writes a crime thriller. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, if you combine a disgraced Boston cop with a bookish Texas special agent and $3 million buried in the desert, you get some of the plot of a new crime novel from Boston Police Sergeant Brian Dunford. Sergeant Dunford works with the Community Service Unit in Dorchester. He's been a patrol officer and detective in Roxbury, East Boston, and South Boston, and now he's with us in studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you come from a family of police officers, right?
Yes, sir. My father was a police officer for 39 years.
Yeah, and he became a superintendent, but you always wanted to be a writer.
I did, and I became a police officer, but the dream was still in my head somewhere, and finally I had a chance. I said, this is the person I want to be, and I gave it a shot.
Yeah. So how did you end up first becoming a police officer? Did you say that you just were going to do this because it was something that your dad wanted you to do? Was that it?
No, just the opposite. I was never really interested, and I started writing about police officers, and suddenly I had this feeling of, hey, I could give this a shot and do it myself. When I became a police officer, I loved it, but the dream of writing something and having a story to tell just never went away.
Wait, so was it always like a side project for you?
It was always in the back of my mind, and I found myself with a little kid at home, and I was doing details every day, and on those details, I found I needed to occupy my mind somehow, and I built a story in my head.
Yeah. Huh. Do you think you needed to have the background that you have in law enforcement to write this type of book, this sort of crime thriller?
Absolutely.
Really?
I read other books, and sometimes you see a fight scene, and I think to myself, this guy's never been in a fight. and unfortunately, I have, and I find them terrifying and overwhelming. But I've seen people who are shot, and I've been the detective who can't let a case go. I've been these things, and I tried to distill it into drama and put it right in the pages of these books.
Right. But it must be difficult because you don't only do that. You also write from the perspective of the criminal.
Yes, ma'am.
Right? Because you've sort of watched the bad guys too, right?
So absolutely.
Because I'm assuming you're not a bad guy. So I wonder, what was it like sort of channeling that to make sure you got that accurate perspective in the book as well?
Well, that's more fun. The bad guys don't have rules. Police officers have to behave themselves. The character you want people to like has to live by certain rules. The bad guys can do anything.
Yeah. But was it difficult to try to put yourself in the shoes of the guy on the other side?
No. This is what your imagination's for, and you cut loose and have fun with it. Right.
So when did you write then? Was it between shifts a lot of times? And like, how did you manage your time? That's really difficult.
Looking back, I don't know how I did it because I had little kids. But little kids take naps. And when they were napping, I was writing. Mm-hmm. And I was working nights, so I'd come home and the house would be peaceful and quiet, which is something that does not happen in my house anymore.
How old are they now?
8 and 6.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Goodbye. So maybe we won't talk about the second book now. But I wonder if this was almost a way of processing for you. You know, processing really difficult things that you had to do as a police officer. Did writing help you kind of work through the really complicated emotions and the tension from some of that?
I think absolutely. One of the things I want everyone to do who works in my line of work is to find something else, and as I call it, taking the uniform off. Whether you're a carpenter, or I know a guy who's a farmer, I know two guys who operate a gym, and I write books, and something that has nothing to do with police work that you can do and be passionate about and fill your time with.
Right. And so it helps balance, right? Is that why? Would you say it helps give you a balance or a relief or release or what? Why? Why should they do something else?
I'd say both. Joseph Wamba, who was a writer and a police officer, said that police work was the one profession where the physical risks were overrated, but the psychological and emotional risks were vastly underrated. And he's absolutely right. You need an outlet that has nothing to do with police work. You need something, someplace to put all that energy and those feelings that you see.
Now, we briefly mentioned sort of the story at the beginning. You've got a disgraced Boston police officer, this special agent who's an accountant and a little bit insecure. You've got $3 million hidden in the desert, drug cartels. Where did you get the idea for this story?
I've written a couple books, and they've always started with just one image in my mind. And this one started with the image of a man dragging a fortune and money through the desert. And that original image, as it usually does, doesn't make it into the final book. But it led me to the story, and I just piece it together from there.
Huh. So I wonder if you could read a little bit.
I'd love to.
So there's a part that you have in front of you. This is when the special agent, the accountant, Walter Curtis, who is working with the FBI wrapping up the interrogation of the bad guy, yep. right, Eduardo Mendez, and the interrogation fell apart because Mendez has realized that he's not going to make bail, so he is going to go to prison. Yep. So he wants to reconsider, right? And he's panicking a little bit. So I wonder if this opens with Mendez asking a question to Walter Curtis.
All right. Walter Curtis has just blown the investigation now because he has no street smarts. So here we go.
Not that you know anyone like that.
No.
Not that you're not going to name on the radio anyway. Okay.
I've changed my mind, you said. I would like to talk. Your lawyer already called us and demanded that we stop speaking with you. Curtis could see him racking his brain for any possible way out of this situation. Curtis had imagined their interview, and in his mind, it had gone differently. It ended with Mendez cooperating. It ended with seized assets, intelligence, and confessions. It ended with Curtis as a star. "What if I know about a murder?" Mendez says as they entered the elevator. "I'm sure you do," Curtis said. Just a few hours passed, and he would have killed to have heard those words. "What if I can give you a hitman out of Mexico?" Curtis knew he could. But no one else believed him, and now it didn't matter. "I still can't speak to you." "What if?" Mendez started to say, but he lost himself in thought before Curtis could answer. Curtis looked at the man and closed his eyes. Mendez had a volcanic desperation about him. He would have said or done anything. "What if I told you there was $3 million buried in the desert?" Mendez asked breathlessly. The doors opened.
Ooh, there you go. And then they go looking. It's kind of dark. Do any fellow officers read the book and say what kind of reaction are you getting?
I was worried about it, but I'm having guys call me up saying, "Hey, I don't read books, and this is great."
Well, good. And despite being in a louder house now, any plans for book number two?
I'm already putting it together in my head. I'm in the outline phase. I write very slowly, like George R. R. Martin.
Yeah.
So maybe this will be a big HBO show before I even get the next one out.
Okay. Sergeant Brian Dunford, Boston police officer who works in the C1 District's Community Service Unit in Dorchester. His first novel is titled South of Evil. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.